Thanks for joining us on the Port City Church podcast. More information about Port City Church is available at portcitychurch.org.
I spend a good bit of time in that passage in Isaiah during this time of year. It just says that he was crushed for my iniquity. It says that the fact that the punishment that brought me peace was placed upon him, and that by his wounds, healing has been brought to me. I have several paintings of Jesus in my office. One is a picture of praying Jesus, which is kind of cool, and one is of laughing Jesus, which I really like because I think Jesus laughs at me quite often. And the other one is this picture of Jesus hanging on a cross. Now, this is not a normal picture of Jesus hanging on a cross that you typically see from the ground looking up at Jesus as he is crucified and dying on this cross. This picture is sort of a bird's eye view looking over the back of Jesus' shoulders as he gives his life. And I think about this because this is maybe where one of the statements that Jesus made from the cross, where he quotes Psalm 22, "Father," or my God, why have you forsaken me?" And I think about this is that picture that God the Father saw right before he turned his back as his son was crucified. As Jesus would feel so alone and isolated as he carried the entire weight of sin and shame for every human being who has ever lived or ever would live in that moment. And he cries out, "Why have you forsaken me?" Well, the reason is because the punishment that brought me peace was upon him. And it is by those wounds that healing would be brought to me, that something that God would do for us would bring salvation. And that's what I want to focus on, is what is this idea of salvation? What is it that you've been really saved from, right? That's the question. If God came to seek and save that which is lost, what did he save you from? And so some of you are here and you come from, maybe you haven't been at church in a while. We're certainly glad that you are here. Others of you have been walking with God for a long time. I want all of us to sort of take a step back and just think about this a little bit differently. Think about this a little bit differently, because the only reason that this story that we're going to talk about on the cross matters is because of what happened a couple of days later when Jesus would come back from the dead, when he would be raised from the dead into this new life that he offers to all who listen. Now, whether you believe or don't believe, the reality is that this idea of the resurrection is the single most transformative event in all of human history. The influence of this man named Jesus is more pervasive on every part of the world than anything else in the history of the world has ever seen, or I believe ever will see. And so what I want to do is explore this way, because I believe it was a real event that happened. It's something that I've staked my life upon and believe deeply. And I invite you to really do the same thing, to consider, who is Jesus? Who is he? And what is he to you? That's the ultimate question, is what are you going to do with him? And so there's this, if I were to title this message, it will be called God on a Cross, God in the Bathroom, and the Salvation of a Snapping Turtle. And that's what we're going to talk about over the next few minutes we have together. And I want to begin by looking at this story on the cross. The Bible records this in the Gospel of Luke. There are four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They were all written by eyewitnesses saying, we have seen these things with our own eyes, we've researched them, and we're recording them in order to preserve them, especially the Gospel of Luke. Luke was a physician. He was a compadre with the Apostle Paul. They ran around together. A lot of his research came. So Luke researched. And the reason he records is he says, I wanted to make sure that history recorded these events of this man really accurately. And so here's his recording of what he learned about Jesus on the cross as he had been tried. And you know the story from Caiaphas to Annas to Herod to Pilate. And all this went down. And then he was ultimately, Barabbas was freed. And Jesus was put up to be crucified. He was sentenced to execution. And chapter 23 of the Gospel of Luke, verse 32 says this: two other men, both criminals, were with him, Jesus, as they led him out to be executed. And when they came to the place called the Skull, they were crucified there with Jesus, along with the other criminals, one on his right and one on his left. So it's kind of an interesting scene that Luke is setting up here. He's like, okay, Jesus was crucified. There was a criminal on his left and a criminal on his right. Crucifixions were pretty commonplace in the Roman government. They wanted to make sure that people behaved. And the best way to do this is when you misbehave, they just nail you to a cross. That kind of squelches a lot of bad behavior. So these guys were obviously relatively well-known. They were insurrectionists, political upheaval. And then there was Jesus, who was extraordinarily popular. And this popularity had turned, and all sorts of things happened and led him to this trial. And now here he is on the cross. And so then Jesus makes this statement, one of the seven statements he makes on the cross, Luke records, verse 34. Jesus cried out as he's on the cross, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." And they divided up his clothes by casting lots. Jesus makes this claim, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing." Now, I don't know about you, But if I were God on a cross, that is not how I would behave. In fact, it's really interesting. One of the scenes that that John records is he says that Jesus was before Pilate. And Pilate's trying to get him to answer some questions. Pilate's like, look, come on, Jesus. I'm asking you questions. Make a case for yourself. Defend yourself. Do something. And Jesus doesn't say anything. And Pilate says, look, don't you know that I have the authority to have you killed? And Jesus says, not so fast, my friend. He says, if I die, it's only because I give my life. No one has the authority but me to take my life. In fact, I have legions of angels at my disposal that if I need them, right, I could call them down to help me. Now, I don't know about you, but if I had legions of angels at my disposal, ain't nobody put no nail in my wrist. Somebody's going to die. That's what's going to happen. I mean, I would use legions of angels to, I wouldn't stand in traffic. I mean, there would be a whole lot of things I would use this power for. And let alone to let someone kill me and then to forgive them as they do is an astonishing thing. This is really what Jesus taught, but this is the whole problem when Jesus would tell people their sins are forgiven. People were like, who gives you the authority to forgive sins? That was the whole dilemma, because only God held that authority, has that authority. So we keep reading. The people stood there watching, and the rulers even sneered at him, and they said, hey, he saved others, let him save himself if he is God's Messiah, the chosen one. The soldiers also came up to him, and they mocked him, made fun of him. They offered him wine vinegar. They said, hey, if you're the king of the Jews, why don't you do something kingly and save yourselves? Now think about what they're asking of Jesus, right? Everybody has a picture in their head. When they say, hey, Jesus, save yourself, everybody understands what they're talking about. Hey, if you're God, why don't you come then off the cross? If you're God, why don't you save yourself? Save yourself by getting out of the predicament that you're in. That's what they're asking him. That would be cool. God, if you're God, save yourself. Get down off the cross. You know, get out of the particular predicament that you're in. Solve the problem that you have. That's how we think about salvation. So one of the, then it says that there's a notice written above him that this read that this is the king of the Jews. One of the criminals who was hung there hurled insults at him and said, aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us. But the other criminal rebuked him and said, don't you fear God, since we are under the same sentence. We are punished justly, for we are getting what our deeds deserve, but this man has done no wrong. So you've got one criminal on the one side going, hey, Jesus, why don't you save yourself like all these other guys said? Why don't you get off the cross? And oh, while you're at it, why don't you get me down too? That's a great strategy. You get down and then get me down and we'll all go about our business and live happily ever after. And the other criminal, he's looking at him and going, there's something else going on. And I think this is really where we find ourselves. A lot of us are sitting over here on one side going, hey, God, if you're God, why don't you solve my problem? Why don't you get me out of the predicament? Because that would be really cool. That's what I would do if I were you, right? And then on the other side, you have someone who says, there's something different. There's something he's doing that is different than anything I've thought or considered before. And the thief looks at him and says, hey, Jesus, look at this. Hey, Jesus, he says, can you remember me when you come into your kingdom? All he can muster is just enough. There's nothing else, no other confession, no theological treatise or anything. Just, hey, Jesus, will you remember me? It's just the simple faith of a guy who has no hope. Will you remember me? And Jesus looks at him and says, hey, truly, I tell you today that you will be with me in paradise. I think this is sort of the dilemma that people have found themselves in for years, and really what the Romans and the Jews found themselves in with their jealous. What do we do with Jesus? What do you do with him when he's in between you? You're sitting there going, hey, why don't you get me out of my mess? Or, hey, perhaps you'll remember me. The other thing I thought was really interesting about this story was what Jesus says is he says, today I tell you, you will be with me in paradise. Now, as I thought about this, there are places that I will go that I don't like, that I will go with someone because I like the person. Like my wife says, hey, Mike, let's go to Sam's Club. I don't like to go to Sam's Club. In fact, if I never go to Sam's Club again in my life, I will be just fine. But if my wife says, hey, let's go to Sam's, I will go to Sam's. Why? Because I like being with her. So I will go somewhere I don't necessarily like to be with someone that I really love, right? There are places that I would go that I would love to go. And I don't care if I like you or not. If you invite me to go with you there, I'm going with you, right? Do you see how this works? So this is what Jesus said. See, one way is I will go to somewhere because the person that I'm with is my joy. The other is I will go to the place with someone because the place is my joy. The experience is my joy. So when Jesus says, look at this, he says, today I tell you, you will be with me in paradise. I want you to think about which phrase you like. Do you like the phrase with me or do you like the phrase in paradise? With me, or when Jesus says, hey, tell you you'll be with me in paradise, you're going, oh, I'm not really sure about you, but paradise sounds good. That's like St. John. Woo, this is going to be awesome. Which, because the reason this is important for you to discern, to decide, is it really sort of begins to tell you your inclination toward what you believe about salvation. And I want to tell you, I think it's something different than we think that it is. I asked myself two questions. I was thinking about this story. Why is it in the Bible, and why is it rescue? Like, why would this story be preserved for us, and why is it about rescue? Well, the answer to the first question is, this is one of the scenes in the Bible where there is no promise. Like, you like, remember, think of this. This is how most of us, you come out of church, you're like, God, if you'll just get me out of this mess, I promise. Like, you're on a plane, the plane starts bouncing around. You're like, God, if you'll just help us land safely, I promise I'll go to church, I'll be nice to my wife, I won't yell at my kids. You're making every promise in the book just to get you down. And that's why a lot of you have come out of church, you're like, God, I'm going to try to get my life right. I'm going to, you know, and you're like making all these promises. And then the thief, there's like, what's he going to do? Hey, Jesus, if you save me, if you remember me, like, for the next 5 minutes before I die, I'll be like really good. Like, what are you going to do? You're like nailed to a cross. How much bad can you do? And there's no promise, just grace. I think that's why it's preserved for us. There are no promises. It's just grace. And that's what some of you need. You need to stop trying to promise God that you'll do all this stuff for him if he'll just save you. He says, no, I've come to give you life. It's here for you to receive, not to promise anything in return. The second reason is that if Jesus doesn't get him off the cross to save him, then salvation must be something else. Right? Because everybody there, including us, has said, hey, save yourself, and us. What we mean is, get yourself off the cross. And if Jesus doesn't get him off the cross, then it means that salvation must mean something different than we think that it does. And that's what I want to explore over the next few minutes that we have together. About this idea of speaking of salvation. About a week and a half ago, I'd been out of town, and I came home, and one of the things I do when I've just been gone for a couple of days, we have a pool in our backyard, and one of the things you have to do is you have to check the skimmer basket. If you have a pool, you know what I'm talking about. There's a skimmer on the top of your pool, and it's a big box. It's maybe 12 to 18 inches, and it's a box that sits at the top of your pool, and water flows in, and it sucks water into the pump, but there's a basket that collects all the leaves and junk that falls in your pool. You have to pick the basket up, and you go dump it out and to keep it clean. That's the idea. Some people say you're supposed to go dump it in your neighbor's yard. Don't do that. But you empty the basket, and you put it back in, and so there's this skimmer that's there. And so I was coming home, and I hadn't been home in a couple of days, so I was checking the skimmer, and I walked out there, and it was at night, about 8 o'clock at night, so it was dark already, or at least getting dark, and I noticed from my deck that there was something humongous in the skimmer. I thought, this is the biggest leaf I've ever seen in my life, and as I got closer, I realized it was a snapping turtle. Now, this snapping turtle, I'm not exaggerating, this is not a pastor story, this is the truth, right? It was at least this big, probably 18 inches across. And he is stuck in my skimmer. So my oldest daughter, Madison, her fiance, Carson, who is an Eagle Scout, was there. And my youngest daughter, Michaela, were there. So I ran into the house and said, y'all got to come out here and help me. There's a snapping turtle in our pool. So we went out there and they looked. They go, oh my gosh, there's a snapping turtle in our pool. I said, that's what I just said. I wasn't making this up. So I have eyewitnesses. So when you begin to look at this snapping turtle, and we get the net that you get stuff out, and he was too big, he would bend the net. So we began to push on him, and he has got his head in the skimmer, and he's like pulling himself, and he's like dug in. He's not going anywhere. So I'm thinking, we got to save this guy. Now, the question is, why do you suppose he was in the skimmer, right? Other than the current, why do you suppose he was in the skimmer? I asked him, and this is what he said. He said, because this is the way out. This is the way out. His head is stuck in. His claws are dug in. He's going, if I can just get through here, everything will be okay. This is the way. Now, I'm looking at him going, no, it ain't. Because I know something about snapping turtles that I did some research. You can only hold your breath for about 50 minutes. You are going to die. See, he is holding on for dear life, not realizing that he is actually holding on to death. You see, there's something you need to understand about human beings. Every longing at the core of who you are, everything that you desire deep down is a longing to be alive. It's a longing for life. That's what you want. If you say, no, my goal is to be successful, the reason you want to be successful is because people will look at you, and when they look at you as successful, you will feel alive. If you want to be popular, the reason you want to be popular is because when people look at you and say, wow, that person has what I want, you will feel alive. If you want whatever it is, what your drive, your ambition, your success, achievement, whatever it is, the reason you want those things at the core is because you believe that when those things happen in your life, you will finally feel alive. That's the pursuit of every human being. Even the things that you do that you wish you wouldn't have done are ultimately a desire to be alive. If someone sort of is unfaithful in their marriage, right? What's their desire? Their desire, the reason they pursue that is because they thought, over here, I will at least feel alive because my marriage is dead. It's this pursuit of life. Even in suicide, right? Someone who takes their own life, what they have come to believe is that in death, perhaps, I will feel more alive. Every longing of every human is a longing to be alive. The reason the snapping turtle was in the skimmer, because he thought that was where life existed. And we knew something different, so we went after him. So we got a rake, we got a pole, we got the pool net, and we began to wrangle him out of the pool skimmer. We got him out in the pool. We lifted him up and got him up on the pool deck. And he's laying there, and I've been around turtles, like box turtles is what we had in Georgia, what I've seen in my backyard. Box turtles, you can walk up, you can like paint like nail polish on them and see how long they live and come in your yard. And when you walk up to a box turtle, if you go to them, they just duck in. Not a common snapping turtle. This is a common snapping turtle, and do not be misled by the name common. There is anything but. I've done some research. Common snapping turtles are actually more aggressive and angry than alligator snapping turtles. They should have reversed their names. But this turtle, when I walked and we got him up on the deck, we thought, oh, we'll just kind of reach over there and get him. When we got up to him, he turns around, he's like, and he bows up. And he pulls his neck in. And he just waits for you to get close. And we put like the stick in the, he's like, pow, pow. I was like, oh, he is serious about this. Now, I actually have done some research. I went, I looked up, said how to pick up a snapping turtle safely. You can Google this, go do it. And some guy walks up, missing two fingers, goes, I'll show you how to do it, right? And he shows you in this video, it's like he has a snapping turtle, and this is true. Whenever you get in front of them, they'll face up. If you go to around them, they turn, and they just keep facing you wherever you are. They are angry creatures. Well, he gets the snapping turtle, he wrangles around, gets it by the tail, and you can't lift him up by the tail because you'll break their spine, but you lift the tail just enough to put your hand underneath him, and you grab it like a football, and you hold it up. So he's showing you this on video. He's like, look at this. And he's in the camera, and the whole time, this turtle's just going, pow, pow, pow. He's snapping everywhere. I mean, like, literally, it's like millimeters from his fingers, and you're going to lose an appendage. I'm thinking, there is no way to pick this bad boy up. So he's sitting there, and we finally get him. We said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to put him on a boogie board. And we're going to drag him out of the yard because there's a creek by our house. We're going to get him out and take him to the creek. We want to save him, right? So I get the boogie board. I push him up underneath. He's right on the pool deck, right by the pool. I push the boogie board up underneath him, and all of us had a role. So I had the boogie board. Carson had the rake. Madison had the pole. And Michaela, my youngest, she's Snapchatting the whole thing, right? She's like, making sure we all this. And so I got the boogie board, and she pushes from behind, and this turtle jumps and snaps at me. I almost fell in the pool trying to get away from this thing. And so I recover. We finally get him on the boogie board, and we start to pull him. And he rides for like a second. And he steps. And he's like, "I ain't having this." So we go get a bed sheet. We lay the bed sheet out. We get him up on the bed sheet, and Carson and I grab both the four corners and we lift up, thinking we are geniuses. Now we have the snapping turtle. We're going to carry him to the creek, and all of a sudden the ground began to shake. Right, and he starts climbing up this bed sheet. I'm not making this up. His head was the size of a grapefruit. And he gets up to the top, he leans his head out of the bed sheet and uses his weight, flips over, lands on his back. In a split second, he flips over and goes, "You want some more of me?" I was like, "What?" He is snapping and he is furious. So now we're like, oh my gosh. And this took about an hour and 20 minutes for us to get this turtle out of our yard. We finally got a big bucket, got him back in the bed sheet, lifted him up, put him in the bucket, covered his eyes so that maybe he'd pretend like it was dark or dead or something. And we lifted him up, put him in the truck, took him to the creek, and we set him free, right? So that's the whole deal. So thought about this. It's like the turtle was saved, but it nearly cost us our life, right? You see this. And I thought about this. I said, we've been saved, and it did cost God his life. And what I begin to think is this turtle thinks that in getting in that skimmer, that's how things are going to get solved. And we knew something that he didn't know. And salvation looked very different than he thought. And he fought it. And he fought it. Until you let go, you are not likely to understand salvation. Because I think all of us, and understandably so, all of us look at God and say, "Hey, God, if you were God and if you loved me, why don't you get me out of this situation? Why don't you solve this problem?" Right? We all want to be saved. We want to be saved from a bad relationship. Like some of you have plans on how to be saved from a bad date, right? You have someone ready to text you. So when it's a bad day, you're like, gotta go. And it's the salvation. We all have these plans. We want to be safe from bad relationships, safe from financial ruin, safe from financial hardship, safe from sickness, safe from all of these things. And we look at God and say, hey, God, if you love me, if you're really God, why don't you get me out of here? And what I want you to hear is I'm not suggesting for a moment that your problems or issues aren't important, because I know that they are. Your drives, ambitions, your hopes, and your dreams aren't important. I know that they are. I've got my own hopes and dreams. I've got things that I long to see happen. There are names on my desk of people that I'm praying for who are going through health issues or family issues or financial issues. I'm praying desperately. God, can you intervene here? We don't ever stop praying for those things. All I'm suggesting is that until you let go of those things, you're probably not going to understand salvation. The reason I'm asking you, inviting you to think about this is because I don't want you to miss the way because you are obsessed with yours. It's interesting. Think about what Jesus came to do. He said, I have come so that you would have life. This is what's written. The Apostle Paul would say, Christ himself is life. I've wrestled with this for 10 or 12 years trying to understand what does it mean for Jesus to be my life? Right? Because see, I think life is some of these other things like success or life, but life is Christ. How does that, what does that mean? And how do we get this? When we look and we say, Jesus, could you, there's nothing else I can give or anything else. Could you just remember me? And that somehow in that, death gets defeated. You see, my sins died with Jesus on the cross. But his resurrection brought life that death simply could no longer touch. And this is my premise. I want you to consider this. If Jesus really is life, if he's life, if that's a true thing, then if you try to live apart from him, you'll never find what you're looking for. You'll live your life, your entire life, separated from that which is life, which is exactly the definition of death. You see, death isn't the capital punishment for sin. Death is the result of being separated from the thing, from that which is life, which is what you've been made for and what you long for in every single thing that you do. What if it really were that simple? Right, I think about this in my own life. What has God saved me from? You know, what is salvation? What has Jesus saved me from? And there are several things that I sat down and wrote down with some thought. But I just looked down and I thought, you know, there are some things that God has saved me, Jesus has saved me from this pressure to perform. I know there are a lot of people who your whole life is about performing for everybody, performing your job, performing your house, making sure your kids perform. Everything is about building this resume. How much pressure does that put on you? How much pressure? Do you feel free? The more success or the better you perform, the more pressure you feel. What if there was a way to be free from that pressure? What if instead of success, you were actually able to simply express who you are? That you could just be you. There's like no greater feeling than just to realize that all I have to do is to bring me to whatever I'm doing. I don't have to perform or impress anybody. That's salvation. That's life. Right? What about maybe your drive has been sort of just, it's just ambition. It's impressing other people. You live your whole life to meet the expectations of others. You live your whole life to achieve all this stuff. What if purpose, what if all you had to do is get up and say, do what you've been asked to do today? How much freer would your life be without the pressure to impress people or perform for people or to succeed or to prove somebody wrong? If you could just live according to the way that you've been made, live the life you've been created for. I think all this anxiety that we feel to get a life is only indicative of the fact that we've never really learned to receive it. You see, when you receive life, you no longer have to try and get it. You actually get to live it. And there's not much that's more freeing than that. It frees you from all the circumstances and all the things that happen. I think this is exactly what Jesus came to bring us, is life and life to the full that wasn't limited by circumstance, and it wasn't stopped by death. You see, one of my favorite books, and it's all time, top five for sure, is called The Pressure's Off by Larry Crabb. And the principle of the book is quite simple. It says, in the Old Testament, God said, hey, if you keep all my commandments, you'll be blessed. It's the hope or the promise of a better blessing. We're like, yes, give me that. But he says there's been a new way that's ushered in through Christ and what he did for us. And that is, there's a better hope by which we draw near to God. One is paradise. If you keep all the commands, everything will go right and you'll be blessed. You're like, give me that. What can I do? Tell me what to do, I'll do it. The other says there's a better hope by which we draw near to God. There's being with someone that we'll go anywhere with, no matter where it is, because he becomes our joy. That's the hope. And I'll tell you, this is a tough choice. It's actually a tough choice to think about having to do some things to get what you want. And some of you have been pretty successful at doing that. Or to let go of those things. Either the fact that you are achieving them or you want them so badly, you just think that if God saw them, you would have it. To let go of those things, to see there's a better hope by which we draw near to God. He concludes this story, this book, with a story from his early childhood. As a three-year-old, he went to his grandfather's house. So the book's probably, this is probably in the late 50s. You can imagine a grandfather's house, probably built in the late 1800s, an old farmhouse out in the country. And so as a three-year-old, he goes to this house, and he loves his three-year-olds. He said, you know, three-year-olds can be fairly independent. They learn to put their shoes on, they learn to dress themselves, and they can finally go to the bathroom like big boys. And so he was feeling pretty big boyish that day. And he decided that he was going to the restroom all by himself, right? I can do it all by myself. So he goes up the stairs, the bathroom, the only bathroom in the house on the second floor of this old house. He goes up there, gets in the bathroom, turns, locks the door, and for a few moments, he feels very self-sufficient. Life is as it should be. Until he goes to leave the bathroom and realizes he can't get the door to unlock. In that moment, he thinks something. He says, I might actually spend the rest of my life in this bathroom if somebody doesn't help me. And so he cries out, screams. His parents come running. Are you okay? Have you hit your head? What's going on? He says, I am stuck, and I need for you to get me out of here. What seemed like eternity, waiting for, why aren't you opening the door? His father had run down the stairs, out to the garage, gotten a ladder, brought the ladder up, leaned it against the house, and propped it just below the second story window that leads into the bathroom, climbed up the ladder, and he says, with adult strength, he lifted open the window. He came in, he walked right by me with that same adult strength, he unlocked the door, and he let me out to play. Thanks, Dad, I said as I walked out. He said, that's how I thought the Christian life was supposed to be. That's what I thought salvation was. You get in a jam, and you can't figure out how to make it work. You do all that you can. You work as hard as you can. When you can't do it, you say, God help, get me out of here. He swoops in with God-sized strength. He walks past you with that same strength. He unlocks and opens the door and lets you back out into the life you most wanted. That's not how it works. That's what we want, but that's not how it works. You see, God came into the window. He came into your dark room, but he didn't walk by you, unlock the door, and let you out to play. He came into your dark room, and he sat down on the floor. And he said, I want you to come to me. I want you to come to me. He seems to think that being with me is more important than letting me out to play. He seems to think that being with me is more important than solving the problem that I most desperately want him to solve. He seems to think, right, that being with me is more important than getting me out of the predicament that I've been in. It seems to me that what he has done for me is different than what I thought he might do or what I would do if I were God. And for some of you, you've been holding on for a really long time, right? You've been holding on to stuff demanding. Some of you have even promised this, God, if you're God, then you would do this. If you're God, then you would take this away. And my prayer has been that there will be tens of thousands of fingers that are released from holding on to these demands that say, God, this is the way. Instead, he came right to where you are, and he sat down in your dark room. And he said, I want you to come to me. I want you to come to me. I haven't come to solve your problem. I've come to save your life. And they're two very different things. You see, if your problem gets solved, it's probably going to be replaced by another problem. If your desire gets satisfied, it's probably going to be replaced by another desire. And it's just this endless cycle of chasing for this life that we most want. And we keep thinking if God will just unlock the door, then you'll have the life, not to realize that we are actually running past the life that he has come to give. When he says, come to me, he came that you might have life. In him is the life. That's what the Bible teaches. When we look at him and say, God, I'm not promising anything. I'm just bringing myself. And perhaps if you would just remember me, he says, that's exactly what I'm asking for. I want you to come to me. He's come to where you are. He's sat down, and he's invited you to come to him. I invite you, I encourage you to stop demanding that he unlock the door and simply come. Because what if, whatever circumstance you find yourself in, what if you found that being with him, being in him, were enough to make you feel full and free and alive, that having your circumstance or problem solved could never, ever do? What will you do with Jesus? He's sitting there and he invites you to come. Let's pray together. God, I thank you that you came to give us life. Father, you've put this longing in our soul that is so deep. And most of the time we don't even realize that what we want is you. We demand the doors be unlocked. We demand the problems be solved. We demand that success happens. We demand that people are fixed and relationships are healed, broken things restored. And what we long for is life. And so you invite us to come. God, my prayer is that all of us would release our demands. We would release them. We would come to you. And God, that as we come to you, we would find that everything else changes. That what you have come to give us isn't just victory over death, but you came to give us resurrected life, to give us life. God, I ask you would call us and draw us, every person within the sound of my voice, for the sake of the way we have been made. And I ask this in your Son's name, who is our risen King. Amen.